Court is back in session.
Good afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. Last case on calendar today is docket number 50350, Guy versus State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
All right, would you like to reserve any time?
Chief, could I make a disclosure just for the record? It's been brought to my attention that while I sat as a district court judge in Department 7, that this the case involving Mr. Guy was in Department 7. However, it's my understanding I did not rule on any contested matters at that time, so I do not feel that I have a disqualifying interest in the case.
That is my understanding also.
All right. And Ms. Rasmussen, would you like to reserve some time?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 of my 15 minutes.
All right.
Okay. May it please the court, I am Lisa Rasmussen, and I represent Curtis Guy, who even the state will concede is the only person on death row in Nevada who's never actually killed anybody. This case has substantial issues that I bring to the court, primarily the ongoing and pervasive ineffective assistance of trial counsel that was present not only in the mitigation penalty phase of this case, but during the actual guilt phase. Mr. Guy's attorney, who unfortunately is no longer alive, was appointed to represent him on the 18th of January, 1991. The actual arraignment, when he was able to speak with Mr. Guy, was on January 23rd. He invoked speedy trial, and the court, out of a sense of caution, set a hearing date, a motion date, for February 14th. And he said, I'll hear any motions that you bring on that date. Not only did trial counsel not file any motions on February 14th, he showed up and said, I don't have any motions, except that I thought I would let the court know that I don't have any discovery in this case. This was for a trial, a death penalty trial, that was to start on March 4th, and that was February 14th. That's how this case started. It is also unclear whether he had spent any considerable time with Mr. Guy, because on February 14th, he requested that Mr. Guy be maintained at Clark County Detention Center rather than being sent to prison on his other cases to which he had pled. It is painfully clear by a review of the trial record that there was no preparation or investigation done into either phase, guilt or mitigation. With regard to guilt, Mr. Guy's trial counsel did not know that this case had gone to preliminary hearing in October or November of 1990, and that the North Las Vegas Justice Court had dismissed all of the charges against Mr. Guy. His trial counsel never knew. He didn't know that Mr. Pendleton, who is the actual shooter in this case, had been dismissed from this case, that he had never been charged with this case, or that he had been charged and then the case was dismissed because he pled to some other offense. He didn't know any of that. He didn't know what theories were being tried, and in part that was the state's fault, because the charges that were brought on the complaint that went to preliminary hearing were conspiracy with intent to commit robbery, robbery with a use of a deadly weapon, and murder with use of a deadly weapon. Those charges were all dismissed. Then when the state brought its indictment in January 1991, the only charge that was brought against Mr. Guy was murder, aiding and abetting. And the whole theory that the state noticed the defense on was aiding and abetting. But then when it came time for jury instructions, after the guilt phase of the trial, the instructions that were given were threefold. They were conspiracy, they were felony murder, which was not ever noticed in the indictment, and aiding and abetting. And the trial counsel, actually, as woefully inadequate as he was, commented on that briefly. He said he felt that he was being sandbagged and that this wasn't the theory the state started off with. In terms of the mitigation, essentially no mitigation was done in this case. The trial counsel presented three witnesses, one the defendant's mother, who he had spoken to for about 2 hours. The other two witnesses that he presented were a girlfriend and a woman from church. He hadn't spent any time with either of those, and they were basically meaningless and had nothing to contribute because, of course, he hadn't spent any time talking to them. He didn't know that Mr. Guy's father is his grandfather. He didn't know that Mr. Guy had tried to commit suicide several times as an adolescent and young adult. He didn't know that Mr. Guy ate cat food. He didn't know that Mr. Guy's mother really couldn't stand being around him because it reminded her of being molested by her father. And he didn't know that she would buy Christmas presents for her other children, but nothing for Curtis Guy. He didn't know that Curtis Guy learned to smoke marijuana and drink alcohol at age 10, that his mother was a marijuana dealer, and that when he wanted marijuana when he was mid-teens, he would take it from her stash. He didn't know that at age 14, he began smoking marijuana laced with crack and that he developed a substantial crack habit after that. None of this was presented to the jury. And I know that this case has languished for quite some time and that this was a 1991 trial, but even by 1991 standards, the counsel was so woefully inadequate that it simply can't be justified. If effective assistance of counsel means anything, it means that this is an invalid and unconstitutional conviction and penalty. With regard to the theories, I've addressed briefly that there was no notice to the defense as to what theories were being brought. And had trial counsel known about the dismissal of the prior complaint in justice court, he might have perhaps had some knowledge of what the state might try to present. He didn't have the preliminary hearing transcript. In fact, appellate counsel didn't even have it, so that's an issue that's never been before this court. We have to look at ineffective assistance of counsel in this case in the context of McConnell as well. This is a case that really is what McConnell is all about. The state still, throughout the briefings in this case, has not identified factually what it is that Mr. Guy did that would support the charges alleged. How did he aid and abet? Because aiding and abetting can't happen by merely leaving the scene, which is factually what happened. Mr. Evans, Caesar Evans, wanted to get some drugs. He didn't have money. Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Guy had some money. Mr. Evans said, I'll take you somewhere where we can buy some crack. Mr. Evans took them to a house. Mr. Guy drove. They gave him $20. So we are talking a rock of crack cocaine, a rock. Mr. Evans' expectation is that he gets to smoke it with them. That's it. That's his understanding of how he might possibly benefit from going to this house. He purchases the crack, comes back, gets in the car, hands it to them. Then when they drive away, he says, I have to go to the bathroom. Probably not as eloquently as I just said it. They stop the car. He gets out. The Curtis Guy drives away. Mr. Evans runs after the car, grabs onto the car, and Mr. Pendleton turns around and shoots him. Even if you look at my client's confession, Mr. Guy's confession, he had no idea that Mr. Evans was going to grab onto the car, let alone that Mr. Pendleton was going to shoot him. There's simply no factual predicate, frankly, for aiding and abetting, or no factual predicate for conspiracy, nor is there a factual predicate for felony murder. Thank you. The mitigation done in this case was actually contrary to mitigation. The trial counsel had never done a death penalty case before, which obviously doesn't equal ineffective assistance of counsel, but he didn't understand what mitigation was about. Anyone who understood what mitigation was about would not have simply put the mother on the stand as a witness to have her testify that she did the best she could and that he had a good life and he was loved. Because frankly, it wasn't true. She didn't love him, and there were many witnesses that were presented at the habeas phase who would have testified to that. She was quite repulsed by him because of how it was he came to be. She had him when she was 15 years old as a result of incest. Look at the timesheet that's in the appendix that Mr. Gower, trial counsel, submitted. It is evident that he spent 3 hours on mitigation total. Now, it is not the client's job to tell the attorney what's helpful in his background. It is the attorney's job to develop mitigation. I think I'm at my 10 minutes, and I'm going to reserve unless the court has questions.
I just have one question, Ms. Rasmussen. You've raised the issue of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel as well. Was that issue raised in the district court?
Yes, it was raised in the district court, I believe in the context of no record below with regard to the preliminary hearing and the there was no record made at the appellate level of the fact that there had been a prior proceeding in justice court that was dismissed. And that was procedurally, that should have been part of the record.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. I think I'd like to, my name is Nancy Becker and I represent the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I think I'd like to start with addressing a few things that counsel for Mr. Guy represented that I think that this court, if it reviews the record, will find are not supported by the record. And that's been one of the problems, I think, with the petition below and with the briefing here, is that there have been some claims made that when you look at the record tend to be exaggerated or given more emphasis than the record itself supports. The statement that this gentleman, Mr. Gower, had never done a death penalty case before. He represented to the court that he had tried at least one, and there is no evidence to suggest that that representation was inaccurate. There is the allegation that this is a product that Mr. Guy, a product of incest. In fact, Mr. Guy's father, Cecil, is his mother's stepfather. So it's a step-grandfather. There's no incest involved in this. It is true that he thought Cecil was his grandfather. It's also true that Mr. Guy was not aware of the true facts and circumstances of his birth until after this case. It never was something that affected him because he wasn't aware of it. The issue with regard to his mother, the statement that she never bought him Christmas presents. The actual trial record is that on one occasion, when he was 16 or 17, his mother bought presents for his younger brother and sister and did not buy him a present. Now, that may show the differentiation between she had treated them, but it also may show that this is a woman with limited means and income who chose not to give her older child a toy or a gift versus trying to provide something for the younger children. It's that kind of thing that I would ask the court look at carefully, because the facts themselves can be substantially different when you look at the record in terms of what was done. The state's theories in this case were aiding and abetting, conspiracy to commit robbery, and robbery, felony robbery. It is not true that the first time that defense counsel had notice of this was after guilt phase evidence had been presented. Extensive argument was made prior to the beginning of trial because defense counsel alleged that until he got the proposed jury instructions prior to trial, he believed that the theory was solely aiding and abetting. One of the allegations is he did not ask for a continuance. Well, what would he have asked for a continuance for? To better prepare to address felony murder and conspiracy to commit robbery versus the aiding and abetting. But if you look at the record, he made numerous arguments, both before trial and after trial, challenging that. Arguments that were raised to this court on appeal, in which this court rejected because it found there was sufficient evidence for felony murder, therefore there was no need to address any alleged deficiency with regard to aiding and abetting and the conspiracy theories. The felony murder in this case is not that Mr. Guy, and indeed the facts are not that Mr. Guy just happened to be driving, drove away, and Mr. Pendleton whipped out his gun and took a few shots. The facts are is that Caesar Evans was looking for drugs. He didn't have enough money. Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Guy were also looking for drugs. They had money, but they didn't have a supplier. They meet up with Mr. Evans, and by Mr. Guy's own statement, the agreement was, you take us to supplier and we'll share the drugs with you. When he exits the car to urinate, Mr. Guy takes off. He drives the car away, intending to strand him. Mr. Evans grabs hold of the edge of the car. Mr. Guy doesn't stop the car. Mr. Guy doesn't proceed slowly with Mr. Evans. Mr. Guy speeds up and drags Mr. Evans around a corner with sufficient speed and force in order to have his tennis shoes, one of them was taken off, the other one was reduced to shreds. That's force, and that force was used, as this court found on the direct appeal, to prevent Mr. Evans from retaining possession of his property, his share of the drugs. As Mr. Guy is doing that, Mr. Pendleton decides to join in and make his own effort to get Mr. Evans to release the edge of the door, and he shoots him three times. That's murder in commission of a robbery, and that's felony robbery in an adequate theory. Is Mr. Gower, was what he did, what we would like someone to do today in a death penalty case? No. But in 1990 and 1991, when he took the actions in this case, the law was quite different in Nevada. First of all, the ABA guidelines that are cited in the opening brief went into effect in approximately February of 1989. It says it was the mid-year meeting, which I believe is February of every year for the ABA. So in about a year to 2 years, when you get up to the trial date, those guidelines had been in effect. But there's no evidence that those guidelines had become some sort of national standard, nor are they a national standard today. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said, the United States Supreme Court, that you may use the guidelines to ask questions about was something reasonable under the circumstances, but you still have to analyze it on a fact-by-fact, case-by-case basis. So in this instance, there have been a lot of allegations that simply because Mr. Gower didn't take an action that was suggested by those 1989 guidelines, that's automatic deficiency. That's not the law. That has never been the law. And a number of the suggestions were not supported by any evidence of prejudice, which is another problem with the petition below. We have allegations that he did not seek psychological testing. There was no psychological testing in the petition below. There was nothing to suggest that psychological testing would have resulted in any additional mitigation evidence. There are allegations that had he done more to talk to Mr. Guy and Mr. Guy's mother, that they would have revealed all of these additional family members as witnesses and the information about their views about the relationship between Mr. Guy and his mother would have come out. The fact that his childhood was an up-and-down childhood. There were times when he was happy, when he had a stable home with his grandparents. There were times when he was living with his mother. And in those times, things weren't as good. The problem with that is that the record does reflect that he did talk to Mr. Guy, and he did talk to his mother. That's how he found out about the two additional witnesses. No one said to him, wow, we've got a lot of relatives in Kentucky. They'd love to come here. And in fact, when the relatives testified, some of them said that they didn't know he was being charged with murder till it very late, until the trial was almost over. The fact is that these people were no longer particularly close with Mr. Guy. They could certainly talk about his childhood. They could certainly talk about how his mother seemed to not give him the kind of love that one would expect a mother to give to her child. But they knew very little about Mr. Guy in his teenage years. And so on cross-examination, had they appeared in a mitigation hearing, you would have heard a great deal of cross-examination about, were you aware as a juvenile that he attacked and held a knife to a young boy's throat so that his mother would give Mr. Guy her purse? Were you aware that one day prior to Mr. Evans' murder, Mr. Guy and Mr. Pendleton attacked Jennifer Courtney because she came home unexpectedly while they were burglarizing her house, and that Mr. Guy suggested, now we need to kill her, and Mr. Pendleton slit her throat. When she managed to escape, they chased her down the street with Mr. Pendleton shooting at her. They would have been asked on cross-examination, were you aware that Mr. Guy, a few days after this, attacked and robbed Mr. French? So that would have balanced quite a bit of that mitigation evidence, even if it had been presented. The issue with regard to the notice, what would have happened had he raised a more formal motion about the notice? First of all, many of the cases cited didn't come into effect until after this trial. So at the time of the trial, notice of felony murder was not required to be in the indictment or the information. That was the case law, so he couldn't be deficient for failing to challenge that. It wasn't required at the time. Geary was not in effect, so the issues with regard to the instructions would not have been an effective assistance of counsel because, again, that case was decided later and the instruction that was given was the correct instruction. This is in our brief. We've gone through that in great detail, so I don't want to go through all of those today. What I would like to turn to is a couple of things that were mentioned in the reply brief that deal with these issues of alleged waiver or Polk confession of error. There are a number of them cited. One of them is that the state, the reason that procedural bars can't be applied and that you don't have to show that they've been overcome on the substantive claims is the fact that the state drafted the findings and they didn't put procedural bars in the findings. We can't put procedural bars in the findings if the district court didn't rely upon them. So to say that that's a waiver on our part, I think, is not an accurate statement. We never addressed good cause and prejudice. Yes, we did. It's there in the answering brief at pages 22 and 23. We said, if you can establish good that it was ineffective assistance of counsel as to any claim, that constitutes good cause and prejudice for raising the claim. There are some cases that were alleged not to have addressed. It's true that we didn't specifically mention them. Turbin is one. But we did argue as to what the law was with regard to the concept of notice and the effect that the prior dismissal at the preliminary hearing would have. And that's that a dismissal in a preliminary hearing, because a justice of the peace determined that, in their opinion, there was insufficient evidence to bind over, is not binding upon a grand jury. It isn't something that the grand jury needs to be advised of. It's not exculpatory evidence. And the statute specifically allows the state, in that circumstances, to proceed by indictment. What the state is not allowed to do is voluntarily dismiss a case and then come back and raise the same case with the same exact evidence. We did not do that here. We're not allowed to fail to comply with important procedural issues in terms of making motions for a continuance at a preliminary hearing, have a dismissal, and then come back and bring another case through the justice court or through an indictment. That didn't occur here. So we addressed what the standard is, and in doing so, I think it's clear we were addressing the issues. When we look at the other issues, for example, Griffin is cited in the reply brief. It's not cited in the opening brief. Griffin has already been overruled. That's the concept that you can't rely on felony murder to substantiate if you find that aiding and abetting or conspiracy weren't valid situations. I don't believe in any of the circumstances when you look at the brief that we confessed error under Polk, and I think we did address them. And so I would ask the court to look carefully at the briefs with regard to that on the reply. What this really comes down to is very simple. This court found there was felony murder. A substantial part of the ineffective assistance of counsel deals with a re-argument that if counsel had challenged that somehow or another, it would have gone away. I submit to you that this court did a very careful analysis. That theory wouldn't have gone away, so the defects on the other two theories, even assuming that they should have been raised in some form or fashion, would not have done so. Did Mr. Gower...
If I may,
I'm sorry, yes.
Just with one question. If two of the aggravators are stricken under McConnell, robbery and pecuniary gain, should this case go back for a new penalty hearing?
I would say not, Justice, and here is why. The two remaining aggravators are that he committed additional crimes while he was on parole, which is an exceptionally strong aggravator, and a prior violent felony, the attack upon Mr. French, where Mr. French, by the grace of God, was not killed, but their intent clearly was to kill him. Mr. Guy was just as active in shooting him, and I think that those two aggravators versus the mitigating evidence that you can say beyond a reasonable doubt that he would have still qualified for the death penalty through the weighing equation, and that the ultimate sentence still would have been death, because in addition you have the juvenile record where he holds the knife to the little boy's throat. You have the Courtney situation where we just talked about, where her throat is slit and she's screaming, running down the street with the two of them chasing after her, trying to finish the job. And so I think that that's the situation. There's one other matter, if you'll permit, that relates to that, and that's exhibit number one. The state did not take and has not taken inconsistent positions. When Haberstroh was issued, the state felt that the opinion suggested that in reweighing, you consider the new mitigating evidence presented in the petition and ask the court to change the opinion to clarify that. The court declined, and this is a matter of public record of which this court can take judicial notice, and found that footnote one properly addressed that issue. The court can also take judicial notice that it has issued numerous unpublished orders in death penalty cases where the court has cited footnote one in Haberstroh and said that mitigating evidence presented after the trial in a post-petition conviction may not be used in the re-weighing function, and that is consistent with federal law on this issue. I thank you for the time. I will rely on the briefs. They're very extensive. There simply wasn't time to address every single one of the allegations concerned. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Let me start with the most recent issue addressed by the state, and I'll work my way back from there. With regard to the court's question, if two of the aggravators no longer exist, what should the court do? It is clear, and I disagree with the state, that you can't consider the mitigating evidence that was presented at the habeas level. The whole reason that we are able to bring ineffective assistance of counsel claims at the habeas level is to point out why counsel was ineffective. So to suggest that you should just consider the two remaining aggravators and what was presented at the trial level doesn't frankly make any sense. I mean, it is not, the only way to do this is to send this back to a real jury with a real lawyer and a real adversarial process, which he never had before. There were things that trial counsel knew and could have said in the penalty phase and didn't. And then there's a whole host of things that trial counsel didn't even bother to find out. But trial counsel knew that Larry Pendleton was the shooter. So for the state to suggest that in a case where Mr. Guy didn't shoot anybody, didn't know that Caesar Evans was going to grab on the car, didn't know that Larry Pendleton was going to shoot him, that is somehow not a factor that a jury would consider, we can't make that decision. We can't make that decision here. With regard to some of the things that the state said, Mr. Gower, I don't mean to parse hairs, but he had never represented to the court that he tried a death penalty case. Levy said he was a lawyer on a death penalty case. But a lot of times we get death penalty cases and they resolve. We plead them out or we plead to life without parole and they don't actually go to trial. And there is, frankly, a big distinction between trying a death penalty case and working one up and then pleading it out.
But you don't know for a fact, you've represented to us that he's not tried a death penalty case. Do you know that for a fact based upon that statement?
There's no evidence that he ever tried a death penalty case.
Or that he didn't try one.
True. But what he said was that he had been counsel in a death penalty case previously. He never said that it went to trial. In fact, the witnesses that were presented at the habeas hearing stated that he did a lot of misdemeanors, and they weren't sure that he had ever even done a felony trial. And those were peers of his from Colorado, where he had spent the majority of his time practicing. There are some suppositions that the state makes. The state supposes that Mr. Guy's mother didn't buy a gift for him because she decided it would be better just to buy gifts for her younger children because she had limited means. That's all us suggesting after the fact what the real circumstance was. The reality is trial counsel didn't make the investigation. Certainly he should have, even if the state
assuming is assuming for the moment that the court were to conclude that under Haberstraw you don't get to argue the mitigation developed during the post-conviction hearing as part of the reweighing process. What would be your reweighing argument under McConnell?
My reweighing argument is that this is a case where we have a defendant who didn't shoot anybody, has never actually killed anybody, and he's not the actual shooter in this case. And even if you were to forget all the other mitigation we know about, this court could never presume that a jury under those circumstances without those other aggravators would come to the same conclusion.
All right, colleagues, do you have any other questions? No? Well, thank you for the arguments today. Thank you for the briefs.
Thank you, Justices.
And the matter will stand submitted, and this court will stand in recess until 9:30 a.m. Thursday.